866. What is on your mind this afternoon, eh? 855-915-9636. As I mentioned in the first minute there, I'm kind of flying solo today. I forgot my computer. I left my cell phone in the car. I've got a head cold. I don't even have a pen and paper. Usually I do some prep beforehand, but today I couldn't do that because my wife was not feeling well. She had to go to work late, and I've got other stuff happening in my family. My car's not working. So, I mean, I'm kind of thrown a little bit off center in terms of the usual routines that I operate in, that we all operate in. And as a result, I'm just doing radio here the old-fashioned way. I'm sitting up on the perch up here at Tufts, speaking my mind kind of as a free float, which is the spirit of this station, by the way, and asking you, the listener, to come on down and weigh in on your thoughts on the issues of the day, the week, the month, the year. Local, national, state, international, foreign policy, domestic policy, issues happening in the news right here in our good old town of Boston. What's on your mind today, huh? 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. Tom Likas, he is a former radio talk show host, a bit of a scoundrel, to put it mildly, fired at WRKO after he was accused of attacking his wife with a stick or something. It's a terrible situation. Charges were brought. And kind of a what we would traditionally call a shock jock. You know, not my style, not what I do at all. But he was a brilliant communicator, and I remember one day listening to him, and he started the program by saying, and this was at a time when the big story of the day was Michael Jackson and the charges it brought against him. You know, the salacious charges of inappropriate behavior. I don't want to get into it, but the point I'm bringing up is that he said, why is everyone talking about Michael Jackson and these charges? This is ridiculous. Don't we have more important things to talk about? What about what's happening in Rwanda? What about what's happening in the tax cuts? What about the this? What about that? We need to talk about serious things. I'm not going to stoop so low as to talk about Michael Jackson. Who cares about Michael Jackson? And his program was a three-hour program, and he went on for 3 hours without a single guest talking about how he was not going to talk about Michael Jackson. And, of course, every caller talked about Michael Jackson, and every time someone would call, he would berate them. Is that all you care about? Is that all you want to talk about? And then they would talk about it in the context of not talking about it. It was brilliant. It was an amazing performance. It left a big impression on me. I mean, in a sense, that's what politicians do. That's what experienced propagandists do, right? They'll talk about something else, and they will do it in a way that that brilliantly at times completely and utterly sidesteps and doesn't answer the issue at hand because they don't want to talk about that. And so I bring this up because I don't want to talk about, and I won't talk about, the fact that the college newspaper here has attacked me personally by calling me names, basically calling me a racist and an Islamophobe. And why I think that the people who wrote that article, there was one reporter who wrote it, but there were a lot of people involved and interviewed. They're students here. It's a student-run newspaper, just like this is a student-run radio station. And that, to me, they're well-meaning. They actually believe that. You know, this is what they're taught. This is, this is the propaganda that they've been so embroiled in, that they believe that their ears tell them, and their conditioning tells them, that if they hear an opinion that is not leftist, it must be these things. That's the only way to explain it. Because as far as racism is concerned, the everything I've ever uttered on this program is recorded as part of the live stream and downloaded. So it's a matter of public record. And really the main issues that I've discussed around race have to do with the fact that I believe and I argue that leftist policies, particularly over the past maybe 40, 50 years, going back to the 1960s, have screwed over the black community in America. They've exacerbated racism. And I get into very specifically why I think so. I also point out that to the degree that racism is a problem today, because I think that things like racism and anti-Semitism and all of those things are never going to go away. You know, they're just there. I mean, it's a darker side of human nature. But the issue we have to talk about from a matter of societal existence and public policy is how is it that those things are a problem for people, you know? Where do they become an issue that would in some way impede an individual's ability to achieve whatever they want to achieve in life? How do they block their ability to advance? You know, how do they make someone feel that they're distracted from enjoying the benefits and the blessings of living in this country? And my argument is that to the degree that happens today, it is largely the fault of leftist policies and a leftist mindset and leftist views of race. I'm not saying that there isn't the old, ugly, you know, fascist kind of, you know, well, I don't want to use the word fascist because I view fascism as a leftist idea, but let's just say the old, you know, white supremacy stuff, you know, the old Jim Crow, you know, kind of, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. I'm not suggesting that that's not out there, but I am pointing out that this is a very marginalized fringe element that is not by any means accepted by anyone other than like a 1/1,000,000th of a percentage of the population of this country, and that it's been roundly condemned. I think that the civil rights movement led by the late great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Was primarily a Christian movement, that the Reverend King was a Christian minister who came from a place of Christian faith, as did most of the members of the Southern Leadership Conference that he headed, including the Reverend Ralph Abernathy and others. And that they made the point that, you know, racism is wrong in general, but specifically racist policies were wrong. Things that prevented people from getting ahead in life because of the accident of race. And he made that point convincingly to the point where that changed the way we see the world, or at least many of us. I think most people, certainly in my circles, never embraced racist ideas. But I'm saying that to the degree that some people did, there was a major change in how we viewed things. I don't think that those sorts of formalized racist things are, you know, I'm not saying they're gone, but they're not the problem that they were. And that leftist policies have exacerbated them to the degree that they're still around. Now, for that observation, I am called a racist. All right? Now, I'm expressing what could conventionally be called conservative opinion. But to our propagandized, conditioned generation of young people attending college today, This is what they're taught. They view this in that context. this brings me to another topic that I wanted to get into today. But before I go there, I just want to mention that this is a news program. This is live, and you can call in. But as such, obviously the big news today, and if you want to talk about it, you're welcome to do so. Give me a call. 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. The big topic today was the firing of James Comey, the FBI director, by President Trump, and the reaction to that. So I'll comment briefly on that, but then I'll get into what I was actually thinking of talking about today before that story broke, and that was Israel and the Arab conflict and what that how that resonates on campuses today and among left-wing activists. But let me go back to the Comey firing. First of all, James Comey himself, in a farewell letter to the FBI, has acknowledged the basic fact that the President of the United States has the right to fire anyone who is a director of the FBI for any reason or for no reason. So there's no issue with this. These agency heads, sir, are part of the executive branch. The head of the executive branch is the chief executive, the President of the United States. And he has a right to fire anyone he wants for the same reason that the CEO of a company or the head of a small mom and pop business have a right to fire someone with cause. I would personally believe, as sort of with a libertarian orientation, that someone doesn't need to even have a cause. If you don't have to hire someone, you don't have to work with someone. If you don't like them, you can fire them. That's your business, right? I mean, to say that someone has to work with another person and pay them against their will, what's that? I mean, if it's not coercion, no one has a right to a job. So the general principle here applies, and I think it's a general principle that we may reflect on and admire, because we want to, in a sense, maintain that same ability over our own lives to decide who is in our life and who isn't, who enters into our home and who doesn't. This is a basic fundamental institution of freedom. You know, even the animal kingdom understands this, right? You choose your marriage, you choose your spouse, you choose, you know, these things. This is just part of existence. So as such, the President of the United States has the right to fire anyone in his cabinet. Now, the fact that Donald Trump did fire the FBI director is unusual because most presidents don't do this. It's very rare that you see. I don't think Barack Obama ever fired anyone. I think maybe the one exception, and I don't know if he was fired, but he was let go somehow. I guess he was fired. Was Van Jones, one of his czars. You know, Obama had all these czars around him. People who were operating in various areas, I would argue, unconstitutionally. But putting that aside, Van Jones had been exposed as someone who had been previously a member of the Communist Party. He did not reveal that when he applied for the job. It was exposed by Glenn Beck, the radio talk show host, and the result was that Van Jones had to resign. But other than that, I can't think of anyone else that Barack Obama fired. I mean, I suppose that Lois Lerner was fired after it turned out that she had engaged in activities that used the IRS for political reasons, that the IRS would penalize people who were on the president's enemies list. That even included a couple of liberals, by the way, but it was probably 99% conservatives. People who were applying for tax-exempt status that would have been given to anyone as a routine matter, she would make sure that they didn't get it. because the government didn't like their politics, and there was also evidence that that she directed her office to harass people and bring them in for questioning, and you know, there were audits and other very, very nasty, you know, Gestapo-like tactics that were used by an agency that is supposed to be non-political and neutral. These are actual crimes, serious crimes. And that, combined with the fact that Lois Lerner had visited the White House many, many dozens of times, it resulted in a congressional hearing. And Lois Lerner responded to those questions by pleading the Fifth Amendment many, many times, dozens of times. And, of course, she had to resign. Now, that, I mean, to my way of thinking, these were serious crimes. She'll never be held accountable. She probably collects her full pension. And nothing, you know, there'll be nothing more than just, you know, a little slap on the wrist for her. But in the case of Donald Trump, Donald Trump is the first president of the United States to not be a politician. He's a businessman. He ran a very large, international, successful company. And as a result, his style is very much one by which he likes to be hands-on. He likes to manage things. And he insists upon things going a certain way. And if they don't go a certain way, he takes action, you know, and he does it fairly openly. I mean, and I know in this case he kind of waffled a bit, tried to pass the buck by saying that it had been his assistant Attorney General Ron Rosenstein who had made the decision, which turned out to be not true. In fact, Rosenstein threatened to resign if he was going to take the rap. That Trump himself made the decision. I get that. But either way, he likes to be the person making the decisions, and he likes to be a person of action. That is typical of a of a private sector businessman. I think it is typical of an American, frankly. It reflects the American ethos, the American spirit, and it's typical of human nature. Now, there are problems around that. I mean, I think that President Trump, as president of the United States, needs to be a little bit more consultative with people around him to, you know, be more deliberative. You know, he needs to consult not only with his cabinet members and his advisors, but he should consult with Congress. And I think that Trump, if I criticize Trump for anything in this, it would be that, you know, he's a little too impulsive. Although they say that he wanted to get rid of Comey from day one. And I think it's awfully ironic that you had left-wingers like Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and others. They were calling for Comey's head to be stuck up on a pole. I mean, they wanted him drawn and quartered because they felt that he had hurt Hillary Clinton's chances to be president. Now, all of a sudden, they're championing Comey, right? Because it's Trump doing it. In fact, Maxine Waters actually admitted as much on television. She said it would have been okay for Hillary to fire Comey, but not Trump. So the hypocrisy there is interesting. But the bottom line is that, again, President Trump has the right as the chief executive to hire and fire anyone he wants in the executive branch. I mean, I think in the case of FBI director, there has to be advice and consent from the Senate. But he makes his appointments or he rescinds those appointments at will. So he's done that as chief executive. Now, there were all, I mean, because he is Donald Trump, and because he is, I would argue, a revolutionary figure, someone who is almost, I wouldn't say radically, but radical in that it's such a change, but it's not, it's the opposite of radical. It's in a sense a move toward common sense government, and common sense, a reflection of a government as it should reflect the private sector. I mean, Donald Trump is moving in that direction. And as such, he has some very, very serious opponents. And it's not just liberals either. And Democrats and, you know, moonbats, as Howie Carr calls them. it's also the establishment Republicans. You know, people like Paul Ryan and others who don't want to see the changes that Trump not only stands for and not only ran on, but who is doing it. He's enacting it. And, you know, it's creating probably the largest change in the way we as Americans govern ourselves since Franklin Roosevelt implemented big government, since Woodrow Wilson implemented world government and internationalism, since Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he is a major change president. He is completely reconnoitering, if you will. He's refashioning the social order, the political order, the world order, if you will. And so, yeah, he has some big enemies. And these people mean business. They want to destroy Trump. They want him impeached. I mean, there's no question about that. There's talk in Congress about they're so angry and they're so flipped out and so hysterical, frankly, over his administration and what he is in fact doing, that they are talking about setting up an impeachment clock, right? They're counting the days. I mean, Donald Trump, no matter what he does, he is going to be in a situation that can only be described as war. And I think he understands that. So if it had been another president, an establishment president, like Barack Obama, or like George Bush, at least during the first 5 or 6 years, or even Reagan, I suppose, if they had fired an FBI director, it might have not looked right. It could have been a story that might have lasted a little bit. You know, there were things about the way Trump went about it that are legitimately to be criticized. But because of the atmosphere that President Trump is operating in, it's more than criticism. It takes on almost like a Wolverine atmosphere. It's like, you know, the jackals are out. It kind of reminds me of the shrill, hysterical atmosphere that swirled around President Richard Nixon in the final week of his presidency, and just as he was announcing his resignation. Nobody could withstand that. The pitch of it got so high. And what was that about? Just briefly, because Nixon was an establishment guy. Nixon was not at all what Donald Trump is. And in a sense, I mean, with Trump, the hysteria could be about 100 times worse by now, and it probably will be. Probably is in some quarters. I mean, what did Nixon do really to warrant an impeachment? I mean, and that kind of tumult, when he really wasn't operating any differently than most presidents, certainly since FDR. In my opinion, and I remember this was a column written at the time, or maybe it was written in the 90s, I think, by Mona Charon, pretty good columnist, right? Her speculation is that this was payback, Nixon's resignation, that is, and his hounding out of office. It was payback for the fact that Richard Nixon had exposed Alger Hiss, the Undersecretary of State under FDR, as a communist spy. And that this was such a tumultuous event. The trial of the century, 1949, 1948, around that time, 1950, that the left, and he exposed Hiss was convicted of perjury and went to prison. And he was one of the darlings of the left. I mean, this was a major insider establishment type, very typical of, you know, leftist establishment. You know, he spoke with a phony British accent, and he was weeping about, you know, his victimization, and and he spoke about the conservatives are something mentally wrong, you know, the milieu, they have something going on with the cerebellum not connected to the cerebrum, and all this crap, you know, this huge amount of analysis on anyone who doesn't genuflect to the left. Hiss was the classic example of that. Amoral, geopolitical, not any kind of a sense of basic understanding of the importance of an objective moral standard. Everything was all about creating some kind of a fashioning, some sort of an order of the world. And the fact that he was a member of the Communist Party on top of that showed exactly what he was, which was a traitor. Probably the biggest one since Benedict Arnold. And that the exposure of Alger Hiss was represented just the tip of a bigger iceberg, which was that the FDR administration, since 1933, when they ushered in the New Deal and all these new employees, which is, by the way, when Hiss entered into public life, and when he catastrophically recognized the Soviet Union, which was a terrible mistake, in my opinion, the administration and the establishment became what you might call amoral. Nothing really, there was no moral standard of American relations in the world. We were going to turn a blind eye to what was the most atrocious regime ever known in the history of man at that time, the time that FDR recognized the Soviet Union, and that was the Soviet Union. We should remember that the Bolsheviks had murdered probably close to maybe 4 million people before Adolf Hitler even joined the Nazi Party, while Hitler was still nothing more than a local, you know, socialist rabble-rouser, you know. So you have, and by the way, I think that it's safe to say that the FDR administration and the left in general were at best ambivalent toward the Nazi regime and the fascist regime in Italy. And in many ways, they admired these regimes right up until it became politically expedient to take another position. It was all about power. It was all about, you know, marching toward the great and glorious, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. Maybe a one-world ant colony. Anyway, you're welcome to join the program. I am live here at WMFO, Chuck Morse, every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m., kind of holding the fort today, doing sort of an open lines program. I mean, I may be meandering about a bunch of things here, but you can bring up any subject you'd like, you being the millions of listeners to WMFO, this great and glorious legacy station. So I'm going to take a brief break, but let me give out the number, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. Come on down.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. ThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman.
We need a new stuntman! Let's break for lunch.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.
$15 is the best I can do.
All right, deal.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
I'm Joe Perry.
And Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, here for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Yeah, you know we love it when the music does the talking.
And you know, the music stops when someone gets killed.
So never, 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 never. never, never, never let someone you know get behind the wheel if they've been drinking. So keep it real, keep it real. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Woo! Let's get crazy!
In movies, when someone at a party jumps into a pool fully dressed, everyone cheers them on and jumps in too. Just so you know, in real life parties, nobody jumps in after you. You just look stupid.
Come on, jump in! Come on!
Most party fouls are pretty dumb, but if you decide to drink and drive underage, you could lose your license and your freedom. Learn more at ultimatepartyfoul.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The federal government alone spends $4.5 billion a year locking up people for drug offenses. It costs almost $28,000 a year just to incarcerate one prisoner. Compare that to the average annual tuition at a four-year public college, which is $5,491, and you realize that the drug war is blurring our nation's priorities. Taxpayers' money would be much better spent educating people instead of punishing them. But thanks to ever-increasing mandatory minimum drug sentences, an entire class of young people are being filtered into new supermax prisons, while the resulting budget crunch forces the rest of us to go to old, dilapidated schools. The more money we dump into prisons, the less we have to invest in college campuses. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out how you can get involved in the war against the war on drugs.
Thank you very much. We're back. You're welcome to join the program. Chuck Morse here at WMFO Medford, 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. What is on your mind this afternoon? All right, I talked a little bit about the firing of James Comey. Talked a bit about, of course, what I'm not going to talk about, which is how this radio, the college newspaper, attacked me personally with ugly charges. But we're not going to talk about that, right? Not today. I'll save it. I want to talk a little bit about the attitudes that I think I've noticed with regard to the state of Israel. This is something that I personally care about, having relatives who live in Israel, having been to Israel many times, and I can witness certain things about the state of Israel because I've been there. I've written several books that deal with topics related to Israel, not directly, but things like modern anti-Semitism and what it's about and that sort of thing. And so I feel that I have at least some skin in the game when I talk about Israel and what I see as anti-Semitic policies that are being embraced by some organizations and college campuses, and by certainly the Obama administration in the past, which is one of the reasons, frankly, that I do support President Donald Trump, in that I think he's moving away from that. In fact, he is. Now, what are those policies? Well, the policy is to boycott Israel. And as most people might know, because it's been covered internationally, but it's also been covered locally, Tufts University is not immune to the controversies around this agenda. The eve of Passover, when Jewish students were away, mostly, except for a couple who are really, real Jew haters, frankly. I mean, they did an article. I don't have my computer here, so I can't read it, but It's almost like they were mimicking the enemies of Israel in their position. But when most Jewish students were away, a resolution was passed in the Tufts University Senate, secretly, I might add, by one vote, called to boycott Israel, or to boycott specifically three companies that do business with Israel. One of them is an Israeli company, two American companies. And, it's sort of the salami principle. The salami principle is that, if you take one slice of salami, it tastes good. You're hungry, so you eat the one slice. Before you know it, you want to have another slice and another slice and another slice. And before you know it, you've eaten the whole thing. And I think that's why this is very craftily conducted. Just these three companies would be boycotted who are doing business with Israel. And they picked three of the things that these companies are doing as a way to market this to the left, that the left would look at this and say, this is terrible, let's boycott them. And they might not even consider the fact that they're boycotting, a country that is a democratic nation, one of the most liberal societies in the world, quite frankly, relatively, and one of the most humane. Instead, they're going to look at these three companies in isolation and what these companies are doing. And what are these companies doing? Well, again, I don't have the information in front of me because I don't have a computer and I didn't memorize it, but I can surmise, I can summarize a little bit. One of the companies helps contribute to what the Palestinian activist group and the left calls a quote-unquote apartheid wall, unquote. Now, first of all, Israel is not involved in apartheid. Apartheid ended when Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa. And Nelson Mandela himself rejected that designation with regard to Israel, and he was a friend of Israel, okay? So let's just put that out there. What they're talking about when they refer to a, quote, apartheid wall, unquote, is the fact that Israel, out of necessity, had to build a barrier between, roughly coinciding with the Green Line of 1967, mainly because they were experiencing the phenomena of people crossing over from non-Jewish regions in Judea and Samaria into Israel with bombs strapped to their bodies so that they could blow themselves up. Now, this wasn't just a casual thing. I mean, we may recall that this was like 2002, 2003, 2004. It was becoming almost every week that these things were happening, that there were these people who would come in try to kill as many Jews as possible. We'll get into why that is in a minute. But the fact is, putting aside whether or not, why they were doing it and the motivation, the fact is that it was happening. It's like, it's like studying, I suppose, any kind of catastrophe. You have to study the cause and you have to study the actual events as a way of learning how to stop it. And any sane sovereign nation, any normal society, protects the lives and the property of its own people. And so Israel, like any sane nation, has a right, indeed it has a moral obligation, if it wants to continue to have a right to exist, to protect the lives and the property of its own citizens from this onslaught. And so the decision was made that the best way to do that was to build a barrier so that people couldn't just walk in and blow themselves up and commit other heinous acts of other atrocities and other human rights violations. And so Israel built the wall or the fence or the barrier. It's a wall in some places. It's a barrier in others. And the result was that it reduced this by about 98%. Israel became a much more secure place. And so, unfortunately, that's how it has to be. It's not that they like building the wall. It's not that, I mean, look, it would have been ideal. It would have been a lot nicer if Israel could have a more open society that they had before the Intifada and before the wall, when Israelis, and for that matter, tourists even, could go into the Judea and Samaria, you know, without too much worry. I mean, you obviously take precautions, but, you know, it's a tough neighborhood. But, you know, people could travel there. I traveled there in 1990. I was there exploring various artifacts around Jericho and in greater Jerusalem. And I felt comfortable. I was there with a couple of Israeli guides, my wife and I. And we looked at, we were interested in history. We looked at different things. We weren't concerned about, you know, now you can't do that in Israel any longer because the hatred has been ratcheted up so much. I'll get into that in a minute. But the fact is, getting back to this company that supplied the building of the barrier, my question to activists who would be against that is, exactly what would you expect Israel to do? Nothing. Let the suiciders come in. You know, really, I mean, you know, it's just common sense. It's like it's the same basic impulse that you use when you lock the door to your house at night or when you lock your car door when you come into the office. You don't want to have your property violated. You don't want to put yourself at unnecessary risk. So you take reasonable precautions to protect your life, to protect your property. Recognizing that there are people out there who will take advantage of you if they can. It may not, the likelihood is slim that that would happen, but why open the door to it? And to the degree that there is a threat, that's the degree by which you take precautions. You know, if you live in a neighborhood which has a higher crime rate, you might have to put bars in the windows, or you might have to get padlocks or bolt locks. Whereas if you live in a neighborhood that has a less of a crime rate, you might just have normal, you know, regular locks. So the amount of security that you avail yourself of has to do with the degree by which your life or your property is threatened. And in the case of Israel, that degree was extremely high. So Israel responded like any sovereign, normal nation or person would do by taking the measures necessary to protect its citizens. Well, this boycott group wants to boycott the company that provided that. And the reason they want to boycott it is because they view somehow Israel as being motivated by, I guess they and I've heard them say this, by racism. Israelis don't like Arabs. I assume that is the case, which is, you know, a terrible, vicious blood libel and a slander against the Jewish people. It's nothing to do with race. But that, of course, begs the bigger question, which is the political question. And by the way, the other left-wing agenda that's been embraced was Obama's terrible nuclear deal with Iran, where he gave Iran the green light to build nuclear bombs that could destroy the state of Israel. And you'll notice that these people were pretty quiet around that. And also, the day that Tufts passed that resolution, may I point out, or at least within that, a few days before, you had someone drive a truck into a crowd of people in London and then slash a policeman to death with continued knife stabbings while yelling, "God is great." And you had a group of people machine gun a Coptic Christian church in Egypt, killing 30-odd parishioners in cold blood. Now, I don't recall the Tufts University Senate asking for any comment on that or any sanctions against any group that might have been involved with that. They said nothing about that. So let's just say that to establish what's going on here in terms of anyone's genuine concern for, you know, moral standards and for ethical behavior, okay? It has nothing to do with that. And having said that as well, let me hasten to point out that Israel, the Israeli military, in spite of exceptional situations, has a very high level of moral conduct in war. You know, I mean, we could take a look at the Gaza war recently, when you had Gaza launching unprovoked missile attacks into civilian neighborhoods in Israel and creating tunnels so they could get in over that border and kill as many Jews as possible. And Israel, we might point out, has no designs on Gaza. They withdrew from Gaza. They helped Gaza set up a government. They gave Gaza training and money and helped them develop the infrastructure they need to have a more peaceful government there. So Israel was not aggressing on Gaza. Israel was defending itself. And the result was a war of horrendous aggression. But the Israeli army responded to this war with very careful conduct, one that should be viewed and admired and studied by nations in the world in terms of how to engage, how to, you know, conduct rules of engagement in war when your country is under attack. Israel could have very easily dropped, you know, one of the, like what President Trump dropped on the caves of Afghanistan. I mean, you know, the MOBY or whatever they call it, the bomb of mother of all bombs, right? That everyone's applauding. And by the way, I think Israel probably has something like that. They could have just dropped that on Gaza and been done with it, but they didn't. They could have maybe ratcheted up, attacks on Gaza by the air and knocked out people. And they did some of that, but they didn't go all the way. Instead, Israel decided that the only way to stop the missiles and stop the firing and stop the war was to put their young men and women at risk to go in by hand and find these things and stop them. And the result was that almost 80 Israelis were killed trying to do this in a way that was more humane. And there were just every example in Israel's wars can be pointed to of that kind of decision. It's a very cool-headed decision that Israel takes in defense of its own country and its own sovereignty. Now, I'm not suggesting that mistakes are made. We can point to certain atrocities. I mean, that's part of war, and things cannot always be controlled, and you have bad stuff happen. I mean, war is a war. But if you take a look at the general ledger, Israel's record is very good when it comes to going out of their way to protect the life of the innocent, and often at the risk of Israeli lives, and Israelis have given their life in that endeavor. So, you know, this kind of propaganda is a damn lie, and it's false. Now, let's go to the bigger question, which is that this is a struggle between two people for the same land. We've all heard the arguments on both sides, and I'm not one of those who's going to come out and say that the Palestinian-Arab position is wrong. I understand it. They believe that they want that country for themselves. They believe that somehow they have a right to it. They've created both sides have created a sort of a historical hagiography in making their claim. No, we were here first. No, we were here second. You know, and it goes on and on and on ad nauseum. My position on that is that both sides can make a case. You know, I understand the Palestinian Arab case. You know, they want sovereignty there. I get it. My claim and my answer to that is that the Israeli case for sovereignty in Israel is the better case. It's not that the Arab case is wrong. The Arab case has many legitimate points. It's just not as strong a case as the Israeli case. And let me see if I can elucidate a little bit in terms of why I think so. First of all, there are, I believe it's 25 Arab, sovereign Arab countries in the world, many of which are oil rich, they're resource rich, they're vast, they have great landmass. And if you add to that the number of Islamic states, you have double that. You've got an area that occupies probably about a third of the surface, maybe a quarter of the surface of the planet, right? I mean, there are sovereign Muslim nations that stretch all the way from the Atlantic seaboard to the South Pacific. They go as far north as Siberia. They go as far south as Madagascar, nearing South Africa. You have a world presence. You know, this is a great, massive, sovereign nation or sets or groups of nations. And the fact that they don't want to make room for the state of Israel and its modest and proper claims, which is that tiny and inscrutable little land between the Jordan River and the Great Sea of the Mediterranean, I think is wrong. I mean, I think that the Israeli claim there is, again, it's modest and proper. And this has been said by many, many reasonable, enlightened Arabs and Muslims over the generations, including Emir Faisal bin Hussein, who became king of Syria and then later king of Iraq, and who signed along with Chaim Weizmann as part of the Paris Peace Conference in February of 1919, what is called the Weizmann-Faisal Accord, by which he, as the chief plenipotentiary of the emerging Arab world, this is right after World War I, when Arab countries were just becoming independent from centuries of Turkish control, that he, speaking on behalf and recognized as the head of that delegation, considered, he was a Hashemite, he was considered a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. He recognized Israel in writing, signing this document. I think it was, again, February 1919 in London. And in that document, he said, and the document lays out, the recognition of a sovereign Jewish state within what he calls modest and proper borders. And by the way, back then, those modest and proper borders included both Israel and Jordan. I mean, Palestine was the whole deal back then. It was both sides of the Jordan River. I mean, later on, a couple of years later, Winston Churchill, as the chief British foreign policy official, created a division, and he created east of the river, west of the river, or Transjordan and Cisjordan. But what it was basically that Faisal had only two conditions for this recognition. And by the way, he was supported by much of the Arab world at that time, including his father, who was the head of the Hejaz, which is today Saudi Arabia. This was before the Saudis took over. It was the Hashemite sheikh who ruled in Mecca under the Turks. That the new state of Israel would respect the rights of the minority Muslim population and would leave in control of Muslims the holy sites of Palestine. Both of those conditions were always met and are met by Israel. You know, the Israeli Arab have equal rights in Israel. The holy sites are under the control of Muslims. That's why they control, for example, the Temple Mount, the what they call the Haram al-Sharif in Arabic. So, you know, those conditions were met, not perfectly. Israel's no utopia. And it's not to say that there aren't some economic disparity between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews. Or maybe I should say Israeli non-Jews and Israeli Jews, because there are Jewish Arabs as well. But putting that aside, let's not get semantic. The fact is that in spite of that, the Arabs of Israel have equal rights to Israelis under the law. The only law that is different is that the prime minister of Israel has to be a Jew. That's because Israel is ultimately a Jewish state. Just like, in a sense, the Queen of England and the prime minister of England of Great Britain has to be an Anglican, by the way. I mean, that's just, it does have a religious element only in that sense. I suppose you could say in America, the president of the United States has to be native born, right? We all remember the controversy around Barack Obama's birth certificate. That's what that was about. The Constitution itself says the president has to be, there are two qualifications for being president. You have to be native born to America, and you have to be, I think it's 35 years old. Okay, that's it. So the point is that Israel was recognized by Ben Hussein, he sent a letter to, at the time, there was an exchange of letters between Ibn Hussein and Felix Frankfurter, who was at that time a major American Zionist, and he was the head of Harvard Law School, in which he said that he welcomes the Jewish people back to their ancient homeland, and that they're our cousins, and that we're looking forward to working together. Now, what was Hussein's motivation? We can only look at the general attitude of what we would today call the moderate Muslims to try to speculate. And I think there were two factors at play in 1919. The first was that, the Arab countries had just become broken away from Turkey, from the Ottoman Turks, or from the Turkish junta that controlled Turkey during World War I. And they were hoping to develop sovereign nations. They had been double-crossed and betrayed by the British and the French, who drew the Sykes-Picot line and who began to occupy these countries. In some cases, in the case of the French, quite forcefully, and create so-called mandates, right? They weren't getting the sovereignty they were promised, that Lawrence of Arabia had promised Hussein when he asked Arab armies to help defeat Turkey in World War I. And their hope was that a newly established Jewish state in Palestine would work with them, newly established Arab states in Syria, Jordan, Iraq, in some of the other, the Gulf states, some of the other surrounding countries, to get sovereignty, to get rid of the colonialists, to get rid of the big powers, to defend themselves. And furthermore, evidence is indicated by the Faisal-Weizmann Accords that he wanted to see the Arab nations grow into modern, free, technologically advanced, peaceful states. And he felt that the Jewish population of Palestine, which was more modern, could help them do that. It was a natural alliance. Furthermore, he was a religious Muslim, and there is text within the Quran that calls for a recognition of Israel as a sovereign state. So it wasn't just a matter of the political. It was also the religious. Anyways, I've reached the end of the program. I can see that Zach is here. Chuck Morse, I shall return, God willing, next Thursday at 10 a.m. Check out my articles on Newsmax and my podcast, Chuck Morse Speaks. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good afternoon.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. I... Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman.
garage.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.